listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Friday, so of course it's time for our national town hall meeting with the guy I think of as America's senator, Senator Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont. His website is sanders.senate.gov. Senator, welcome.
Great to be with you, Tom.
So what's on your mind today?
Well, there's a lot that's going on. It's been a busy week. Let me just tick off some of the areas that I've been working in. I'm chairman of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. So we have been working very hard to try to bring together legislation that I introduced, and along with Senator McCain, that passed the Senate overwhelmingly, with legislation that passed the House, in order to make sure that every eligible veteran in this country gets high-quality care in a timely manner, in a timely manner. There are a number of places around the country where veterans are on long waiting lists. That's not acceptable, and we're working on that. The two goals is to make sure that if a veteran today can't get into a VA facility in a timely manner, short term, he or she should be able to go to a private doctor. Longer term, obviously, we need to strengthen the VA so that they have the numbers of physicians and nurses and psychologists and other medical personnel they need. Sloan Gibson, who is the acting secretary of the VA, testified before my committee on Wednesday that they need about 10,000 new medical personnel, and we're working hard to make sure that they have that. One of the issues that I think is just really, in a sense, almost overwhelming, Tom, is that when we talk about the cost of the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, it's not just the 6,700-plus people who died or the people who came back without any legs and arms. We are talking, according to a number of studies, of somewhere between 400,000 and 500,000 men and women who came home with post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury. And these are really tough problems. And on any given day, if you can believe this, some 50,000 veterans are walking into VA facilities getting outpatient care for mental health issues alone, given day, 50,000 people. So we've got a lot of work in front of us. I think VA today provides good quality care in most cases. I want to improve that care, but most importantly, right now, we want to focus on access, making sure people can get in a timely manner. We held on Thursday, yesterday, a very interesting hearing on another committee of which a subcommittee in which I chair, which is a committee on primary health care and aging. And if I were to ask you, Tom, a question, if I were to say to you that right now the leading cause of death in the United States is heart disease, second leading cause of death is cancer, what would be your guess about the third leading cause?
I would probably guess accidents, but I don't know.
Good. Well, that's a good guess. That's not quite right, but that's up there. This will stun the American people, which is why we held this hearing. The leading cause of death, third leading cause of death in this country, is preventable deaths which occur in hospitals.
Whoa.
Okay. Seriously. We're talking, a recent study came out which suggests that between, no one knows exactly, but people don't argue with the numbers, that between 200 and 400,000 people a year die who should not die of problems that occurred in hospitals. This is not the illness they came in with. It's a problem that they acquired either through an act of commission on the part of the hospital or that the hospital is not doing something that it should be doing.
These are referred to as iatrogenic conditions.
Exactly.
Doctor caused.
Right. And one of the guys, in fact, the fellow who wrote the latest study, which was peer-reviewed, and really I've not heard people who disagree with his numbers, of between 200,000 and 400,000 people a year dying in hospitals from preventable deaths. What motivated him is his own son passed away a number of years ago in a way that he should not have.
Wow.
From preventable deaths. But you have issues of infection, and what was disturbing is, according to some of the experts that we had a great panel of folks, and one of the doctors was saying that there are hospitals in America now where you have particular types of infection which exist at a rate 10 times higher than in other hospitals. So some hospitals are doing a good job. They're addressing the problem, and others are not. So you have a discrepancy of 10 times in dealing with particular types of infection. Then you have other problems, just simple problems. And this is what the fellow who wrote, his name is Dr. James, wrote. And he said that his son was told, his son collapsed while doing some running and went to the hospital. I won't go all the details. But among other things, one of the doctors understood that he should not be engaging in athletics for a while anyhow. He should not be running. That wasn't communicated to him. So what you see is very often the lack of communication to the patient. So you'll have many elderly people leaving the hospital with a dozen different drugs, not really knowing what the drugs do, not knowing when to take the drugs, not knowing the effect of mixing one drug with the other drug, just lack of basic information. We have a situation where some 15,000 people a year die from overdoses of prescription drugs, not because they intend to abuse them. This is not an addiction issue. It's because of poorly worded information on the drug bottles. So if we could do a substantially better job, and this, by the way, is not just an American problem. It's a problem that exists all over the world, in dealing with best practices to make sure that we eliminate infection as best we can, make sure that doctors are communicating effectively with other doctors so that patients have a better understanding of what their situation is, do a better job with information technology so that hospitals can transmit information to nursing homes, to rehabilitation centers. We will do a lot better in cutting down on unnecessary deaths. So that's a big issue that we've been working on.
Is there a piece, if I may, when I grew up in Michigan, hospitals were required to be not-for-profit or corporations. During the Reagan years, that changed. And I think that changed in a lot of states. And this is how Bill Frist's father made $3 billion, was buying up these formerly not-for-profit hospitals and doubling and tripling the nurse workload and cutting staff. I've had a number of nurses and a couple of physicians over the years call into this show and say that ever since their hospital went for-profit, you know, everything's gone to hell in a handbasket.
Well, I think overworked nurses is certainly a part of the problem. And I think your point is well taken, that if you're running a hospital for profit, you, one of the ways that you will make more money is by putting a heavier workload on nurses and doctors, in fact. But in general, this is a national problem which has a lot to do with, I think, best practices. Some facilities have done a good job, and they use things like, unlike what they use in aviation. When you get on an airplane, your pilot goes through a checklist of all of the things that have to be done. And increasingly, we're seeing that in hospitals, making sure that when a patient gets medicine, that the right patient is getting the right medicine, that you're not giving somebody else's medicine to the wrong patient, that the dosages are correct. So sometimes it's pretty basic stuff. It's like washing hands and making sure that people are washing their hands often enough and appropriately enough. So I think your point is well taken. I think for-profit hospitals, which push the envelope in terms of maximizing profits at the expense of quality care, are going to have special problems. But I think this is kind of a serious problem all over the country. The other issue I wanted to touch on is the issue of net neutrality. Early in the week, I held... Okay, we can talk about that after the break.
Yeah, we'll figure it out after the break. We'll be right back, and my apologies for steering you off on a tangent there. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be right back with more of Senator Sanders. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders. We'll be back with your calls with Senator after this. And welcome back, Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Senator, did you want to...
Well, just a couple of the brief issues. One is the issue of tax inversion, where what we're seeing now in a rapidly accelerating rate is these large corporations, Walgreens is the latest, who are literally moving their headquarters away from the United States, in the case of Walgreens going to Switzerland, with the express purpose. No one has any ifs, buts, or maybes about it. It's very clear, in order to avoid paying taxes in the United States. So you've got these companies, historically corporate America over the years, thrown millions of American workers out onto the street because they moved to other countries for cheap labor. And now many of these same companies and others are now moving abroad in order to take advantage of cheaper tax rates abroad. And, you know, it is an issue that has got to be dealt with. This country has a large deficit, but more importantly, we have enormous numbers of unmet needs in this country for our kids, for our elderly. And if these large corporations are deserting the United States to go to abroad, we got to deal with that issue. If they want to do business in the United States, if they want to do business with Medicare, Medicaid, with the defense industry, you know what? They're going to have to pay their fair share of taxes and they can't run abroad. It's a huge issue. The problem is accelerating and it's one that we have to deal with.
All right. Anything else, or shall
no,
we pick up a call?
Questions.
Okay. Kathy, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Etna, Wyoming. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I wanted to ask you, I was watching C-SPAN earlier this week, and I saw McCain, Hoeven, and Barrasso standing on the floor giving their pitch for natural gas and liquid natural gas and shipping it to Europe, and particularly mentioning Ukraine. They said that this fuel is not going to cost the taxpayers anything, and they said this over and over again. But I called all three offices because I know for a fact here in this state, we're having to clean up the abandoned wells that companies are becoming bankrupt, and they're walking away after they've made all their profits, and we taxpayers are cleaning up the mess, not to mention what it's doing to the environment. But my question to you is it illegal for them to stand on the floor and blatantly lie to the public?
Kathy, unfortunately, it is not. I mean, you know, that's what the First Amendment is about, is the right of anybody to say anything that they want to say. When you're a member of Congress, you get more immunity if you say it within the halls of Congress. But the issue of, you know, what you see is Republicans using every opportunity that they can to push benefits for large multinational corporations, whether it's oil, gas, coal, or whatever it may be. In this case, we're dealing right now with the Keystone pipeline. We're dealing with provisions in the Ex-Im Bank, which help fund coal-burning plants around the world at exactly the moment when the scientific community is as clear as it can be that global warming is a huge and catastrophic problem facing this planet. The idea of expanding the use of fossil fuels rather than moving boldly and aggressively as quickly as we can to weatherization, energy efficiency, and sustainable energies is exactly what we have to do.
We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders in just a moment. It's 20 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Check out the Senator's website at sanders.senate.gov and also his Facebook page over on Facebook. We'll be right back. The hour. It's a Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And Thomas in Flint, Michigan, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders and Tom, thank you for the opportunity. The question I have is, with all the decisions being made by the Supreme Court, what's the best way to try and get C-SPAN in there to watch them as at least recorded, like SCOTUS on C-SPAN hashtag or something like that? What's the best way to do that?
Well, I think you got to put pressure on the Supreme Court to make that happen. You know, Congress is on TV. I was on two hearings this week, which were televised on C-SPAN, and I think the Supreme Court should own up before the American people what they, you know, what they're talking about. But beyond that, beyond making sure that the American people can hear what these guys have to say, I think I agree with you that the Supreme Court has done just extraordinary damage to this country in recent years. I mean, just the last couple of weeks with this Hobby Lobby decision, which says that an employer can make medical decisions for women in terms of their reproductive rights, in terms of the outrageous decision versus Citizens United and the other one dealing with McCutcheon, making it easier for billionaires to buy elections. And I think the American people have got to be very active in speaking out against these Supreme Court decisions. Supreme Court does not live in a vacuum. They will respond to pressure. Just this week, for as a matter of fact, on the floor of the Senate, we voted to overturn, in a sense, the Hobby Lobby decision to make sure that employers cannot avoid providing health benefits to women in terms of reproductive rights and in terms of birth control. We are also working hard, and there will be a bill coming to the floor of the Senate within the next couple of months to overturn this disastrous Supreme Court decision on Citizens United. So in terms of the Supreme Court, in terms of these terrible 5-4 decisions that the very conservative members are making, I hope that listeners are actively engaged in trying to help us overturn some of these awful decisions.
Okay. Anita, in San Antonio, Texas, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I want to ask you about the long-term unemployed and if anything's, you know, being done about that. I don't hear anybody talking about it. And I have a brother that's been unemployed for a year, and he luckily has family help, but I just don't know what people are doing. I don't know how they're making it.
Well, Anita, thanks for raising the issue. I wish I could give you some welcoming news. I can't. The Senate passed legislation which would extend long-term unemployment benefits. And what I think people should understand is that the numbers of people, percentage of people who today are unemployed for long periods of time is at almost at record-breaking levels. So while we have seen some upticks in the economy and a lowering of unemployment rates, long-term unemployed folks are having a really, really hard time getting work, and they do need help. And I believe that, and I think a majority of the people in the Senate believe that. We managed to get something passed in the Senate. But what every listener has got to understand is that the Republicans, the right-wing Republicans who control the House, their agenda is pretty clear. And that is any tax break that comes along for billionaires or for large corporations, they are for. Any program that comes along to help working people, lower-income people, the middle class, they are against. And that means, in this case, they are adamantly against extending long-term unemployment benefits, despite the fact that, A, it will help a substantial number of people, and, B, it is good for the economy, because when those folks, including Anita's brother, have some money in their pocket, they're going to go out spending it. And when they do that, they create more jobs. But whether it's long-term unemployment benefits, whether it is Medicare, whether it's Medicaid, whether it's education, these guys are voting no, no, no. Cuts for working families, ignoring the needs of the middle class, but more tax breaks for the wealthy and large corporations. That, simply stated, is exactly what the agenda is of the Republican Party and the folks who control the House.
Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thanks, guys. The only thing the clueless do-nothing Republicans know how to do is destroy jobs with their budget cuts, shutdowns, debt ceilings, sequesters. Yet they constantly say, where are the jobs? Well, thanks to the policies of the Democrats and an independent senator from Vermont, there has been 10 million jobs created in the last 5 years. The rest of the jobs are in fixing our roads, bridges, schools, building VA hospitals, reinstating unemployment insurance, and raising minimum wage. Isn't it true that the only way all these jobs will be created is if the Republicans are voted out of Congress?
Well, Paul, thank you for that question, and I agree with exactly what you said. You know, and I, you know, Tom, I hate to sound, you know, overly partisan here, but sometimes if you're telling the truth in terms of what's going on right now, and that is what an extremely right-wing U.S. House of Representatives is doing, you got to tell the truth. When you do that, you are being partisan. And Paul's point is exactly right. While we have made progress, you know, I want everybody, Americans have a short memory span. Let's not forget where we were when Bush left office and Obama came into office. Republicans are saying, oh, the economy is not doing as good as it should be. Well, no kidding. It is certainly not. Wages are too low. Unemployment remains too high. Where were we 5 years ago, 6 years ago, when Bush left office? We were losing 700,000 jobs a month. We're on the verge of an international financial collapse. So has job growth been as strong as I would like to see it? Absolutely not. Have many of the new jobs been created, being low-wage jobs, part-time jobs? Yes, that's the unfortunate truth. But Paul's point is right on, spot on. And that is, we can create jobs by rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. We can, for every $1 trillion we invest, we can create 13 million jobs doing work that absolutely needs to be done, and we're getting no support for the Republicans.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Your calls for the senator right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And check out Senator Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for his free newsletter. You can hop over to his Facebook page. All kinds of great stuff there. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Sanders on the line with us, answering your questions in our national town hall meeting. And Al in Buffalo, New York, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, good afternoon, Senator.
Good afternoon, Al.
I'd like to say right now we have we have 2,609 signatures. We need 3,000. We plan to sue the current GOP in Congress.
Is this a moveon.org petition?
Yeah, that's exactly, moveon.org.
So the GOP, in response to their suit against Obama,
that and the fact that they have basically, here I'll read what it says: the GOP Congress have not done their jobs. They keep wasting our tax dollars on fake investigations, trying to sue the president, shutting down the government, doing absolutely nothing.
You got it, Al. I got it. We know the rest of the story. You're absolutely right. And this is, you know, it's funny, Al, if you know history, in 1948, Harry Truman was not expected to win re-election. He inherited the office after Roosevelt died. And he won. And he ran against a do-nothing Congress, Republican Congress. Well, let me tell you something. I don't know what it was like in 47 or 48, but this Congress is the biggest do-nothing Congress in the modern history of America. We are accomplishing absolutely nothing. And let me be clear. The reason is that the Republican Party is not interested in Congress in anything other than more tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires and large corporations, and in cutting every program that benefits the middle class or working families of this country. And what we need to do is not just sue them. More importantly, we need to throw them out of office. And I hope very much that working families throughout this country understand that if they don't get involved in the political process, as bad as the situation is today, if the Republicans gain control over the Senate, it's going to get worse. And you're going to see savage attacks that we have been able to beat back up to now in terms of cuts in Medicare, in terms of cuts in Social Security, in cuts in Medicaid, cuts in education, cuts in nutrition. And in many instances, we've been able to beat those back, and in some cases, such as long-term unemployment, we have not. And we heard earlier in this program that people are hurting because they're not getting those benefits. But there is a war going on against working families and the middle class, led by the billionaire class, represented by the Republican Party. And if only 40% of the people come out to vote in this November election, which is what the estimate is, and if 70 to 80% of low-income working people do not vote, and young people do not vote in overwhelming numbers, it is very likely the Republicans will gain control over the Senate with an agenda that represents just the 1%. So, Al, thank you for what you're doing in terms of educating people and organizing people. That is exactly what we need to do.
Michelle in Albuquerque, New Mexico, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, thank you so much for everything that you do. I have a question about Social Security. I keep reading that more and more Social Security offices are being closed and that there's a move afoot to outsource those jobs to private companies to put Social Security basically online, making it less and less accessible to old folks like me. What can be done to change this?
Well, thank you, Michelle, for raising that issue. When I talk about the Republican assault on the middle class and working families. Michelle just raises one of 50 ways that that is happening. We have fought back against enormous efforts to cut Social Security benefits through a so-called chain CPI. And my office and some other senators and some people in the House work with senior groups and unions and women's groups and disability groups, and we prevented cutbacks in benefits. But what is going on, what Michelle is talking about, is that in terms of administration, the needed manpower to make sure that when people process claims, they get timely responses, we have seen significant cuts. And what Michelle is talking about is that offices around the country are being shut down. And the argument is, well, it's not a problem. Everybody can go online. Well, for a variety of reasons, not everybody can go online. And sometimes people need face-to-face contact, but you need to be able to speak to somebody on a telephone without after waiting 3 hours listening to music before you can talk to somebody. So Michelle's point is right in terms of Social Security, and that is an issue we're conscious of, Michelle, and we're working on. It is exactly the same issue in terms of the IRS. What the Republicans have done is cut back on funding for the IRS so that the IRS will not be able to audit their millionaire and billionaire friends or organizations that use the IRS so they can get away with not paying their fair share of taxes. And that's basically what it's about. So what Republicans day after day are trying to do is destroy the infrastructure of government so that we can provide quality care to people through government services, or to make sure that the wealthy and the powerful stop paying their fair share of taxes. And Social Security is just one example.
Jim in Lockport, Illinois, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, once again, it's a privilege to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Jim.
Yeah, my big question is this, Senator Sanders. I've touched base with your staffers, and I've asked them a question, and hopefully they relayed the message to you, is why is it that the Democratic Party doesn't remind the Republican Party of the $24 billion they wasted on that shutdown? Now, you and Senator McCain had devised a bill for the VA hospital, and I thought it was a pretty good bill. And that $24 billion could have been used to strengthen the VA,
yep,
along with our border security issue and the refugees coming across. So we should be pounding that issue like salt into an open wound, I believe.
Jim, I mean, ouch. That is, look, when you talk about the government shutdown, essentially what you are talking about, and Jim is right, I think it is an issue we have to keep pounding away in, is that what the Republicans have been absolutely adamant about is that in the midst of enormous need in this country, a crumbling infrastructure, we have moving toward a third world in terms of our infrastructure, in terms of bridges, which are in absolute disrepair, roads, water systems, wastewater plants, a rail system, airports. We need to invest hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. Republicans don't want to do that. In terms of the high cost of college education and student debts, we need to help those young people not be chained down by these high debts, make college affordable to all of our people, regardless of income. In terms of global warming, we need to transform our energy system and create a substantial number of new jobs, moving away from fossil fuel into energy efficiency, weatherization, and sustainable energy. And yet on each and every one of these issues, the Republican Party says no, 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 and they're working on behalf of the big money interest. So the government shutdown, Jim, is one example of it. It takes place every single day. And the message has got to get out to working families that we are going to see the continued collapse of the middle class. You're going to continue to see more and more people living in poverty. You're going to continue to see more and more wealth and income inequality. 95% of all new income today goes to the top 1%. And in terms of wealth, the numbers are equally bad. So people have got to get involved. They got to stand up. They got to fight back, or else the future of this country is going to be pretty dim indeed.
Charlie in South Portland, Maine, watching on sanders.senate.gov on the website. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I'm your neighbor here in Maine. It's wonderful to talk to you. I just have one quick question. Why doesn't Harry Reid get rid of the 60-vote majority on bills, period? Because you know if the Republicans win and take back the Senate, even if it's 51-49, they're not going to hesitate to do that in a heartbeat. And if we had done that in the first 2 years, Obama had the Congress, they had Pelosi as Speaker, and all those bills were passed. Immigration, jobs for construction, infrastructure, all those votes passed in the House.
Hey, Charlie, you know what?
Get them passed in the
Charlie?
House. Yes.
I agree with you. Four words. I agree with you. You are right. I think we should have done it. I have fought for that. The answer that Reid, as to why Reid has not done that, I think is a pretty simple one. We don't have the votes. So right now in the Democratic caucus, there are 53 Democrats, two independents, Angus King of your state and myself. A strong majority of those people agree with what you said. And I want everybody to understand what Charlie is talking about. Many people think that to get a bill passed in the Senate, you need a majority vote. You know, you win 51-49, 52-48. 48, 46, people are absent, whatever it is. That is not the case. That used to be the case, but as a result of Republican obstructionism, every important or semi-important piece of legislation now requires 60 votes. We don't have 60 votes, which means one of two things happen. Either nothing happens, we can't get the 60 votes, which is almost always the case, or occasionally, if you get 60 votes, you have to compromise it down and make it a bill much weaker than it otherwise should be. Now, what Harry Reid did do, because he was just profoundly disgusted with Republicans not only filibustering against all types of important pieces of legislation, but against presidential nominations for a variety of positions or judges, he did change the rules regarding nominations, presidential nominations, and judges. And we have gotten a lot of those guys through in a reasonable period of time. But you're right, Charlie. We should take it to all pieces of legislation.
We'll be back with Senator Sanders in our Brunch with Bernie Hour right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out Senator Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov, and also his Facebook page. And welcome back. Joan in Chicago, Illinois. Actually, Joan, hold on. Your radio station is off the air or is in a commercial break right now. Let's pick up a Free Speech TV call here. Jared, watching Free Speech TV in Burlington, Vermont on the cable system there. Jared, you are on the air with your senator.
Bernie, this is Jared Wood. I'm from Burlington, Vermont. When Ross Perot was running for president, he talked about the sucking sound. Yeah, he referred to NAFTA. Since then, we've had not only NAFTA, but we've also had CAFTA, and looming is SHAFTA. My question is not only economically, but politically, we're tying ourselves onto the Far East. As it stands now, we have agreed to defend Japan, and Japan is under the Abe administration, is moving in the direction of going to war. I guess my question is there any way to reevaluate some of the sort of 1914 type interlocking agreements, which will, using Mr. Perot's words, suck us into yet another conflict?
Well, Jared, your question touches on a lot of issues, trade and foreign policy in particular. You're talking, as I trust you know, as a Vermonter, to somebody who has been vigorous in opposition to all of these trade agreements. You may recall that way back when NAFTA was being decided, we had a big rally down in Montpelier, Vermont, in opposition to NAFTA and post-CAFTA and probably most importantly, permanent normal trade relations with China. Sadly enough, and this speaks to the in a sense, corruption of American politics, is that it didn't matter who was president of the United States. When big money wanted a trade agreement, which would allow companies to shut down in America and move to Mexico or move to China, hire low-wage workers, and then bring their products back in to America tariff-free, the results of which have cost us, by the way, millions of decent-paying jobs and huge trade deficits. Both parties, the president said yes, whether it was Reagan, Clinton, Bush, Obama. This unfettered free trade has gone on for decades now. In my view, it has been a disaster. It is one of the contributing factors to the race to the bottom and why the middle class in this country is disappearing. You know, young people in America don't even know that there was once a time when you went shopping and you bought products that were made in the USA and not in China. Many of them don't know that. And yet, of course, that is the case right now. So, Jared, in my view, we have got to fundamentally rethink all of these trade agreements. We have got to rebuild our manufacturing base. We have lost over 50,000 factories in this country in the last 15 years, and that's millions of decent-paying jobs. And you're not going to have a middle class unless you have manufacturing, and you're not going to have manufacturing unless we change these trade policies. Your other question dealt more with foreign policy issues, and I guess entangling alliances, maybe to quote George Washington here. And I think, you know, that's something we should be rethinking. We have gone through two terrible wars, which have been very costly to us in terms of human life and treasure. And, I do think we should be rethinking some of that.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us in our Brunch with Bernie hour. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this. Here with you 10 minutes before the hour. Joan in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. I was wondering about the proposal of building more VA hospitals. Is that going to be to take care of what we have now? I was wondering, like, in the future, are we going to still need those hospitals unless we're going to be in continual conflict?
Well, that's a good question, Joan, and I certainly hope that we're not going to be in continuous wars. What the VA is trying to do, what they increasingly do, is not build new hospitals unless they have a sense that in that particular area there is going to be the need for those hospitals. We are seeing in certain parts of the country significant increases in the numbers of people who are coming into the VA. In other parts of the country, we're not seeing that at all. Mostly what they are doing, just to address your issue, is leasing, not buying, not building. So they're not buying, they're not building, but they are leasing facilities often in a 10-year period. So they can make a decision if they need to expand, they can renew the lease, they can go someplace else. If they have fewer people coming in, they can downsize. So it is, you know, certainly the intention of creating more space for the VA is to make sure that we can better accommodate the folks who need VA services. Right now, in many facilities, there are not the examination rooms that doctors need, and that slows down their ability to take care of veterans. So, no, this is not anticipating more wars. This is taking care of veterans so they get quality care in a timely manner.
Mark in Chico, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good morning, Senator Sanders and Tom. Senator Sanders, I called you about my feet, and I want to thank you and your staff. I have an appointment with a doctor on Monday, I just really appreciate
your help. Well, thank you very much. I guess that's through the VA, correct?
Yes. Well, actually, it's going to be a private doctor.
Good.
But, Mark, you had a question for the senator?
He spends right now almost $5 billion a year contracting out to private doctors and facilities, and where the VA can't provide the service, that's what they do, and that's what they should do. And I'm glad, Mark, that we were able to help you.
But I do have a question. This Hobby Lobby birth control, you know, that affects all of us, not just women. That affects all our families and everything. And with a Republican Congress, how are we going to deal with this situation? Because It's a big can of worms that has been opened up.
Yes,
and
it is.
It's going to get worse and worse.
Well, you're right. And we tried. I will tell you that just this week, we tried to get legislation to overturn what the Supreme Court had done. We were not successful. I think we have three Republicans supporting us, and we could not get, as I mentioned earlier, the 60 votes that we need on almost every important piece of legislation. So majority voted to address that issue, but we didn't get the 60 votes and overwhelming opposition from the Republicans. And you're right. It opens up a can of worms. If I am an employer and if I say not just that I'm not comfortable providing insurance to women for birth control, what happens if I'm saying somebody in my office has AIDS? Somebody is gay. I am not comfortable. It's against my moral principles. Or maybe, to be an extreme case, maybe I'm somebody who doesn't believe in modern medicine at all, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you can carry this to ludicrous extremes. But the point is that it should not be an employer dictating what the healthcare needs and desires are of employees, which, by the way, I mean, goes well beyond Hobby Lobby. It goes to the fundamental issue of whether healthcare is a right or a privilege. Or just, maybe you work for a good employer who has a generous health care plan. Maybe you work for an employer who provides no health care at all, and you have nothing. In America today, despite the modest gains of the Affordable Care Act, we've got about 40 million Americans who have no health insurance at all. We are the only country in the industrialized world that does not guarantee health care to all people as a right through a national health care program. We end up spending far more than any other country per capita on health care, and our outcomes are not particularly good. So the real issue here, it's not just Hobby Lobby, as bad as that decision is should every American be entitled to health care as a right? Should that, of course, include reproductive rights and birth control? And the answer is yes, but that's the fight that we have to wage.
Got about 2 minutes, Senator. You want to take another call or wrap it up?
Let's take a call.
Okay. Tony, in New Lenox, Illinois, a quick question for the senator, please.
Yes, it's my honor. Just want to say every week at work I push the Sanders Warren ticket, and that leads me to the question, Mr. Sanders, are you or anybody on your staff currently developing ways to deal with your obstructionism once you are president? And you have yourself a great weekend, okay?
Well, the answer, Tony, whether I am president or anybody else is president, let me be very clear about this. Yes, I have thought a lot about it. And I will tell you what, many Americans may not want to hear, is that no president, no matter how good he or she may be, is able to address the enormous problems facing this country unless there is, in a sense, a political revolution, which means that millions and millions of citizens in this country have got to be acting politically in a way they have never acted before. We can't beat the Republicans in Capitol Hill just through negotiations. What we need to do is have millions of people stand up and say, you know what? We are going to create the millions of jobs that this country needs. We are going to provide health care to all people. We are going to address the crisis of climate change. And anybody in Washington, anybody in Congress who is not prepared to do that, you're going to be unelected pretty shortly. And when people speak, when workers speak, when young people speak, when students speak, when women speak, by the millions, that is when change takes place. And no president is going to accomplish what has to be done without that type of political revolution and that type of grassroots activism needed to support progressive change.
Senator, thanks so much for being with us today.
All right, my pleasure. Thank you.
We'll talk to you next week. We'll be right back.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And our old friend, Professor L. Randall Ray, W-R-A-Y, Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Senior Scholar at the Lovey Economics Institute and author of Modern Money Theory. He blogs over at neweconomicperspectives.org. Twitter is UM Kansas City is on the line with us. Professor Ray, welcome back.
Hi, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Could first of all, you have a mission-oriented finance for innovation conference coming up in the UK. You wanted to mention something about. You want to give us the heads up on that?
Well, sure. This is a project that I'm running with Mariana Mazzucato, and what we're doing is integrating the work of John Maynard Keynes, Joseph Schumpeter, and Hyman Minsky to try to figure out what we're going to do to try to redirect finance away from financializing our whole economy and toward promoting capital development of the economy, public infrastructure investment, private investment, and also innovation.
Wouldn't a lot of that be accomplished through changing the banking laws?
Well, we definitely have to change the banking laws. We need to supervise what the banks are doing. And we might need the creation of new kinds of financial institutions, say public development banks, for example, in order to provide finance where we really need it.
Very interesting. You also wrote a piece that Nouriel Roubini published over on EconoMonitor. It may have been in other places. That's where I read it.
Yeah.
It was titled "Join the Protest Against Home Theft." That's home theft. That's strong language. By whom?
By bankers.
By bankers.
There are a number of ways that they do it. I think that, you know, it's not a stretch to say that a lot of foreclosures really are home theft. I mean, literally, in some cases, the banks are taking homes where people don't even owe any mortgage whatsoever. And what I've been focusing on over the last, 4 years or so, is this industry creation called MERS, which is the Mortgage Electronic Registry System, which has screwed up property records so badly that even if banks wanted to be honest, they don't know what they own. They don't know who owes who, and neither do we.
What happened to the paper trail?
Well, in most cases, they destroyed the documents, apparently, which is why we had that wave of Burger King robo-signers a couple years ago.
Because they were trying to reinvent the documents?
They had online advertisements saying, hey, do you need us to create the documents that you've lost? Yeah,
wow.
They were forging documents, absolutely.
Wow.
Because they don't exist.
And so what can the average person do about this? You say this is all illegal.
It's very, very tough. Some homeowners have gone to court, and some of them have won, and some of them have lost. There are also institutional investors who are getting involved here. We just had a report of a $7 billion settlement that made a lot of news. Eric Holder got that. But the institutional investors, people like PIMCO and BlackRock, are also suing the banks over issues related to the securitizations. And their lawsuit right now is actually $250 billion.
Whoa.
So it's not just individual homeowners. We've also got institutional investors who know that they were screwed by the banks in the securitization process.
Well, that's a lot bigger than the, what was it, $7 billion that the federal government just took out of the hide of Citicorp.
That's right.
You wrote a piece called Egregious Fraudster Introducing Bob Rubin's Citicorp. Tell me about that.
Well, this was a case where there was a whistleblower at Citi who even wrote to Bob Rubin saying that, look, the mortgages that we're packaging together into securities and selling to Fannie and Freddie, which, of course, are government-sponsored enterprises, so essentially here they're screwing the government, these don't meet what are called reps and warranties, which is the bank that is originating the mortgages and then selling them to be securitized are claiming that, hey, these are good mortgages, when in reality they weren't. This whistleblower documented that 60% of the mortgages did not meet the reps and warranties. So they were screwing the investors in those securities. Now, there's all sorts of other kinds of fraud going on, but this is the big one that PIMCO is going after.
Mm-hmm. And you know, again, what can the average person do about this?
Well, one thing that I wrote about on my blog was an attempt, a protest, to try to stop this steamrolling process that has been undertaken to legalize an electronic registry system. So MERS was created by the banks themselves, so it's an industry monster created to speed up the securitization and foreclosure process. And now what we have is that the banks have gotten together with the Fed and with others to legalize this and create a national electronic registry system. Now, it's not necessarily a terrible idea to do this, but to have the bankers in charge of putting the thing together is really scary. It's going to reproduce what MERS has been doing. In the old days, we had written documents, and if you had a mortgage and bought a house, this was recorded with your local recorder. And so everything was above board. It was completely transparent. You could find out who owned your mortgage, who you were supposed to make payments to, who owned the property. You can't find that out anymore because it's all in this MERS electronic registry that only the banks have access to.
Wow. Wow. Should people then, if somebody's going to buy a house, for example, should they be trying to avoid dealing with the big banks and instead go to a local community bank or something like that? I mean, what are some of the ways that average Americans can protect themselves from the fraudsters and the banksters?
Well, you should be very wary of buying a foreclosed house because it's very likely that the banks have destroyed the property records, and this could come back to haunt you in the future if the person who lost their home can show that it was, you know, stolen.
Right.
They can get their property back.
Does title insurance help you in cases like that?
The title insurers started to get scared, too. I remember a couple of years ago, some of them were refusing to write title insurance on at least some of the foreclosed homes. But, you know, title insurance is only as good as the insurer, and we found out in the collapse of the subprime mortgages, a lot of that stuff was insured, too, and the insurers went under.
Whoa. Whoa. So in the minute we have left, we're talking with L. Randall Ray, professor of economics at the University of Missouri. NewEconomicPerspectives.org. In the minute we have left, what do you see in the near and long-term future for the economy of the United States?
Well, housing is not recovering. A few months ago, people thought that we saw a recovery underway. It looks like that has petered out. I know that the jobs data came in a little bit better than what we expected, but most other data on the economy does not look too good. I think that we're probably slowing down rather than speeding up.
So we're sliding into another recession?
I think so. I think it's going to be very hard for us to recover when we still have so many homeowners underwater and losing their homes, which depresses the affordable neighborhood.
Right, and it also depresses demand in the general economy because those people are paying their mortgages instead of buying things.
That's right.
Professor Ray, it's always great talking with you. Thank you for dropping by today.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Check out his blog, or where he blogs, over at neweconomicperspectives.org. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we'll be right back with Anything Goes Friday. Your calls right after this. Tom Hartman with you. It is Anything Goes Friday. And keep it simple, stupid kid. I don't think I wouldn't go on to call you a stupid kiss kid in Yucca Valley, California.
Okay.
How you doing, kid?
It's fine, Tom. That's what Daddy taught me. You got
okay.
a problem, stand back, say to yourself, keep it simple, stupid.
Okay.
Anyhow, you're with Comcast?
I'm with Comcast. What do you mean?
My first 7 calls to try to talk to Bernie today
uh-huh.
rang once. It came on. That number is no longer in service. Let's see if anybody else got that message. Also, I
That's
spent
weird.
5 hours with Time Warner yesterday.
Hang on just a second. Which number were you calling?
Pardon me?
Which number were you calling when you got that message?
Oh, I have it. You're twice in my book. Let me get to H.
Okay.
Attorney General Hartman, 866-745-2667. What you got on the screen? I finally got.
Yeah, that's our 800. That's one of our 2-800 numbers. The other, yeah, that one rolls over on to 202-536-2370. Should work just fine. You might be getting that message when we've got only 12 inbound lines, and when they're all full, you might be getting that kind of an error message rather than a busy signal. I'm not sure.
Well, I don't give them any excuse because it's never happened.
Yeah.
Also, I'm going to be real quick with you because I'm in school, and
okay.
my questions have to be quick and concise. In 1964, I campaigned for Barry Goldwater. I stuffed envelopes in the afternoon, and then me and my father and all the other kids and their father, we didn't put 5-cent stamps on them. We took these envelopes door to door, and
my dad and I did that too.
Yes. It's great, and to go when people invited my father in and my mother in, and to hear them talk, it was so beautiful. But also, real quick, I'm so sorry for Sean's loss of Rod, and I will be sending to the Hunter School. Everybody's got to say this to people. This is not a midterm election, like somebody mentioned. It's
right.
a congressional election,
right?
And I ripped off I got so sick and tired of Dick Cheney when I heard the history books will justify him. I called the White House, I called Sanders' office, and many other representatives, senators. You know, you have to use a little humor when you write. But can I read you one sentence? I know you don't like
sure.
stuff read.
One sentence. Go
Listen,
for it.
Listen, Dick, I'll see you in hell. I'm going to punch you in the nutsack every time you try to speak. It's a promise, Dick. You're dying, I'm dying. We might just meet. I'll see you. And, you know, I acknowledge Rude Pundit because,
yeah.
oh, boy, you know. And then I basically say, the new American century, William Crystal, Pearl Harbor-like event, 9/11. You knew, didn't you, Dick? One last favor. Please tell the truth. You knew it was coming. That's all you needed.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. Kid, I want to move along. It gets more calls in here so that other people aren't getting, you know, the error signals that you got. But I'm with you. Good statement. Liz in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just want to get through all this because you threw me in the next week with all the last guest call. Did you want me to stay on point with economics, or can I just ask my question?
You can ask any question you want, Liz.
Okay. Am I the only one that has a problem with what's happening with legal immigration right now? I mean, I don't agree with what just happened in the state of Florida. I paid it. Well, first of all, when I went to college, to establish residency in the state of Florida, I had to be here for 3 years, and then the rates only dropped in my fourth and fifth years of college. But now something changes recently in the state. I don't know if it's because of Rick Scott, but now illegals are getting that rate that I couldn't get.
You're talking about in-state tuition rates.
Right. And then, and why am I saying this when on TV the other day they were showing illegal immigrants doing robotics who went to MIT, bumped out rich people's kids, and subsequently their jobs? I can't believe I'm even talking about this. Why aren't they bitching about it? Because they're the ones taking daddy's money and getting bumped out by illegals.
This, Liz, the question illustrates the need for, the need for some sort of a comprehensive immigration reform, and for something like the Social Security database, the employer database, so that employers who hire people who are not here legally can be fined or even imprisoned. And, which would stop the problem of illegal immigration. We don't need to build a Berlin Wall on our southern border. All we need to do is put some of these rich white guys who are employing people who are not here legally in jail. And it would end very quickly. With regard, however, to the refugee crisis that we have on our southern border, that's a whole different can of worms. There you've got people who are fleeing specifically three countries in Central America. They're not fleeing from Belize. They're not fleeing from Panama. They're fleeing from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, where Ronald Reagan was pumping up the death squads, and the death squads are at it again.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I put all of this at the feet of Ollie North and his buddies in the Reagan administration, who got off scot-free, by the way. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Anything Goes Friday. A couple hours. We are going to have Professor Stephen Cohen in our third hour to talk about the situation in Ukraine. Wanted to get his thoughts on what's going on. The White House is saying that it looks like, you know, with a fair level of probability, that the Malaysian Airlines plane was shot down by Russian separatists, not Russian separatists, but Ukrainian separatists who want their part of Ukraine to reunite or something with Russia, and that Russia has been providing arms and material to these people and support, and the president is saying, you know, time to stop it, and let's have an international investigation into this. It's going to be a really interesting thing to watch. My guess is that if we don't know exactly who pushed the button on the missile, that the Russians do, and I probably shouldn't speculate. In fact, I'm not going to speculate. We'll see how this plays out. I don't want to add fuel to this fire. Doug in Chandler, Arizona. Hey, Doug. You want to talk about debt?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Doug.
How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
In the midst of corruption and greed and Republican hyperbole.
Yeah, there you go.
Happy Friday.
Thank you.
Hey, Tom, I want you to tell me I'm nuts when I get done.
Okay.
We owe about $17 trillion. The Republicans constantly use it as a bludgeon, you know, to get votes. Pushing it to the most, $4 trillion of it is owned by outside countries. Right?
Arguably, yeah. I think my understanding was it was more like three, but
United States.
Say what?
The rest of that $17 trillion is owned by the United States.
Well, a couple trillion of it is owned by the Fed and by U.S. government agencies. Most of the rest of it is owned by people within the United States, institutions within the United States, pension funds, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. What would happen if we just said, "Okay, we'll wipe all that debt out"?
Well, you would be wiping out investors. The when the government issues debt, the other people buy that debt for the interest that they get off it. It's The thing that's important to note, Doug, is that government debt is the same thing as private savings. And so you would be, if you wiped out that government debt, government debt is necessary, actually. I mean, this is something that Alexander Hamilton pointed out, that people want to be able to invest in something that is safe and not necessarily all flashy and doesn't necessarily produce the best returns, but it's absolutely safe, and government treasuries are that investment. If you were to wipe out that debt, you would destroy the credibility of the United States as a place to invest.
Okay, that's what I wanted to hear from you. But, you know, what people need to understand is, no, China doesn't own that $17 trillion.
No, China owns about a trillion of it, various entities within China own about a trillion of it. But and there's really no downside to that. They can't just say, hey, you know, we want our money. It's just, you know, it's
an investment.
Yeah, and beyond that, the fact that the government has, you know, provided $17 trillion worth of investment-grade bonds to people inside and outside the United States is really pretty irrelevant. It doesn't affect our economy. As long as there's demand for U.S. bonds, as long as the bond yield rate is fairly low, it's completely irrelevant. And what it means is that we could sell a lot more bonds, and we could use that money. We could go another $1 trillion in debt and use that money to rebuild our infrastructure, and go a second $1 trillion in debt and use that to wipe out all our student loan debt and make our colleges, our state institutions, at least free, like many of them were free or close to free, you know, back before the Reagan era. And you would see, much like we saw with the GI Bill, cost us whatever it cost us. I don't remember the number off the top of my head. But when we looked at the increase in tax revenues over the lifespan of the people who went to college on the GI Bill, their increased earning, because they were college graduates rather than just high school graduates, the taxes that they paid on that increased earning more than repaid the government for the cost of the GI Bill. We made a profit on the GI Bill. This is why pretty much every government in every developed country in the world provides free college education for its young people, because they know that if they spend $1 trillion on free college education this year, over the course of the next 30 years, they're going to get back $4 or $5 or $6 trillion in extra income taxes. Not to mention the positive benefits to society of having, you know, educated innovators and inventors and improved standard of living in their country.
Good job, Tom.
Okay,
so
thanks.
I shouldn't run out and be scared to death when the Republicans tell me that the debt's going.
The debt is irrelevant. It's completely irrelevant. It only becomes relevant when people start questioning the ability of the government to pay it back. That's when you see bond prices start going up, because the government has to offer a higher rate of return in order to attract investors. And that's not going to happen. Yeah, we could double our debt before that would happen. In fact, I think we would have to more than double it. Japan's debt, right, you know, for the last 20 years has been more than 200% of GDP. And, you know, their bond rates are still very low. People are still buying Japanese bonds. It's not a question of how much debt the government's in. It's a question of how much wealth the government has. And our government has a wealth, you know, has, you know, well over $50 or $60 trillion in assets. So there's just, I mean, we're, you know, one of the strongest economies on earth. So our government debt is not an issue. If you want to look at debt that is an issue, there are two kinds of debt that actually are possible. In fact, not possible. They are an imminent danger to the United States. The first is the $35 or $40 trillion in private sector debt that exists. That's a bomb waiting to go off, particularly the trillion of it that is student debt. But much of that is corporate debt. What's happening is these corporations are issuing bonds, and then they're using that money to buy other corporations, which is not productive. I mean, Microsoft just bought a phone company, phone manufacturing company, and now they're laying off somewhere between 6,000 and 16,000 employees. That's not, you know, and they leveraged it with debt. That's not an appropriate use of debt, right? That's using debt to increase corporate profits, but it hurts the economy. It hurts workers. I mean, they're laying people off. So, number one, you've got this private sector debt that is massive, and it's being used inappropriately. That's what Randy Ray was talking about at the top of the hour. And number two is our trade debt. We, you know, every year, between 400 and 400 billion and $1 trillion, we buy from other countries more than we sell to other countries, and our trade deficit, that's our annual deficit, our total trade debt is greater than our is greater than the $17 trillion. You know, if you aggregate it all the way back to, say, the 70s or the 60s, when we started going negative on our trade, we had trade surpluses right up through the Reagan administration, and then it started going negative. And you add that all up, and it's greater than $17 trillion. And that's a real problem, because that's money that the country has hemorrhaged, number one. And number two, what that means is that people overseas who are holding these dollars that we gave them because we bought junk from them, or we bought oil from them, or we bought stuff from them, the only place that they can spend those dollars ultimately at the end of the day is in the United States. And so what do? They come over here and they buy real estate. They buy companies. They buy, you know, pretty much anything that's not nailed down, and even a lot of stuff that is nailed down. And so we're seeing America slowly being bought out. Economyincrisis.org, I think, is the website. There's a really good website that just tells this story. And they do a very, very good job of it. It might be economyincrisis.com. It's one or the other. Doug, thanks a lot for the call. Gene in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Well, hello. I'm glad to speak with you.
Well, thanks for calling. Thanks for listening to KTRC.
I usually try to listen to you. And this morning I heard again Bernie complain about Americans' poor memory or short memory.
Yeah.
And I think I have a reason. I never heard either of you try to figure it out or what it might be about. And I started shopping years ago at Organic Store when I moved out here. And I noticed when I went, picked up the flour sack, it had non-bromated. So I looked it up and started doing research and found out that bromate is put in most food in America, a whole lot of food in America, and that it makes people lethargic. And bromine or bromide was used during the war by the Russians and Germans to make their prisoners lethargic. They could handle them better. And I'm wondering if that's what's happening to America. I've never heard you comment on this, and I was really hoping you would one day.
Gene, I've never heard of this. This is new to me.
Well, it's going to shock a lot of people. It's in their fast food, it's in their bread, if you buy at regular stores. When I first went to Whole Foods, I asked them about it, and they won't allow it in anything. So for years, I've been buying unbromated flour.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important because people don't realize what fluoride is doing. It's just a byproduct of making aluminum, and they found a way to make money, telling you it stops, you know, tooth...
Well, it does harden your teeth, but people are concerned that it might be hardening your bones too and making them more prone to fracture. I've read the stuff. I don't know. I'm not qualified to speak on these things. Gene, thanks a lot for the call. I'm far more concerned, frankly, with the death of the middle class right now. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anything Goes Friday. More of your calls in just a moment. Today is the 18th of July. Some of our... In 1864, President Lincoln asked for 500,000 soldiers for military service. He was looking for volunteers. On this day in 1925, Mein Kampf was first published, Hitler's autobiography and rant. On this day in 1937, Hunter Thompson was born. On this day in 1940, FDR was nominated for his third term at the Democratic Convention. On this day in 1947, Harry Truman signed the Presidential Secession Act. On this day in 1966, Carl Sagan turned 1 billion seconds old. It's interesting. Thanks to Sue Nethercutt for compiling this stuff. On this day in 1980, a federal court voided the Selective Service Act because it didn't include women. That's interesting. On this day in 1984, Walter Mondale was nominated in San Francisco for President of the United States by his party. On this day in 2013, Detroit, Michigan filed for bankruptcy. And on this day in 1984, 21 patrons at a McDonald's in San Ysidro, California, were slaughtered by a guy by the name of James Hubbardy. Boy, we've been doing that for a long, long time, haven't we? Anyhow, Jeff in Las Cruces, New Mexico, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, no, Jeff, what's up? Jeff, you are on the air.
Hello.
Hey. You're on the air, sir. Jeff, you are on the air.
Yes.
You got to listen to your phone instead of your TV because we are.
I'm going to mute it. It's not Jeff. It's Tom. It's John.
Oh, John. Okay. John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I've been on the phone about an hour and a half. I tried to talk to Bernie, but that's okay. I understand Friday's busy.
Yeah.
I just have two questions for you. A little footnote. While I was on the phone, your voice came on. I assume it was you. It was a commercial that said we're sponsored by Geico and Quicken Loans. And I thought you guys didn't do commercials, but I just wanted to let you know that. I don't know what happened there.
Yeah, it said we are underwritten by. If you are,
I mean they give money to your show. That's good then.
Yeah. Well, actually, they give it to the. Sure.
Yeah. Two questions, real quick, Tom. I won't hold you. Mainly the Supreme Court decision, Hobby Lobby,
mm-hmm.
Five Christians.
Five Catholics.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, they are all Catholic. And the Senate they couldn't even pass an override, let alone trying to get it past Bonner.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what anyone can do. Like that lady from Santa Fe was just talking about lethargic people. And
right. Well, as long as we have a Congress that's not willing to regulate the Supreme Court, and not even willing to pass legislation to clean up, you know, a hole in the law that the Supreme Court pointed out, as long as Republicans are committed to obstructing everything, we're screwed.
Yeah.
And then that's why we've got to show up this November and change the makeup of both the House and the Senate. It's going to be really, really hard. I mean, in the last election, Democrats voting for members of the House of Representatives pulled 500,000 more votes. 500,000 more people voted for Democrats for the House of Representatives than voted for Republicans. And yet, because of gerrymandering by Republicans in Republicans-controlled states in the 2010 and 2000 elections, because of that gerrymandering, the Republicans control the House, even though 500,000 more people voted for Democrats. So we got to get 1 million more people, or 2 million more people voting for Democrats. This election is really important. And yesterday I was apparently mispronouncing the name of Mr. Eldridge Gerry. I was calling him Mr. Gerry because they call it gerrymandering, and it's G-E-R-R-Y. But it turns out one of his heirs, I think, sent me a note. It was somebody whose last name was Gerry. Gerry, and said, no, it's pronounced like Gerry. Okay, thank you for that. That said, let's check in with Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
I see you are at the White House. What's going on?
I am. Well, President Obama spoke a couple of hours ago in the Brady Press briefing room, addressed the issue of yesterday's tragic plane crash in Ukraine, the Malaysian plane, MH17. He said, and Samantha Power, the UN ambassador, also said at a meeting of the UN Security Council that the U.S. believes, according to its intelligence, that the flight was taken down by a surface-to-air missile from territory controlled by Russian militants battling the Ukrainian government.
Well, these are actually Ukrainian militants who have an allegiance to Russia.
Well,
would that not be more accurate? Or was he saying that these were actually Russian citizens?
Well, he said militants. He said separatists, actually. He said separatists. Let me put it that way. He said separatists. He did not say that it was separatists who brought it down. He said that it was brought down from territory controlled by.
Right. Yeah, there's still a lot of questions here.
He said there were questions. He blamed Russia's government for doing too little to control militia groups in Ukraine. He said that violence in the region had been facilitated in large part because of Russian support. And he said time and again, Russia has refused to take the concrete steps necessary to de-escalate
the situation. Power said the Malaysian jet was likely downed by an SA-11 missile, and she said it was operated from a separatist-held location in eastern Ukraine. She said that the U.S. cannot rule out that Russian personnel provided technical assistance to Ukrainian separatists suspected of attacking the plane.
Right.
But that is as far as they will go. Other people are going further, but they are not going further than that.
Yeah, my guess is that whoever fired this missile, that, you know, a bunch of these separatists, these Russian-speaking, ethnically Russian Ukrainians in the eastern side of Ukraine, are basically, you know, they're like the Michigan militia. I mean, they're you know, kind of hillbillies. You know, they're equivalent. They're yahoos, and they're not thinking carefully, and they're not behaving like a well-organized militia. And they're just shooting at anything they see, and hopefully this will wake up the world to that.
And that was one of the things that President Obama, he said. He said, I think that this certainly will be a wake-up call for Europe and the world, that there are consequences to an escalating conflict in eastern Ukraine, that it is not going to be localized, it is not going to be contained. He also spoke about, and I don't have anything in my two stories here, which is rather surprising to me. Let me just check I don't have anything here, because that is a little... Yes, there is something in one of my stories. He spoke at the end of his remarks, and he did take a few questions. He mourned the loss of about 100 HIV-AIDS researchers and activists who were headed to the 20th International AIDS Conference in Australia aboard MH17. Saying they were a reminder of the good in the world amid a stream of conflicts. These were men and women who had dedicated their own lives to saving the lives of others, and they were taken from us in a senseless act of violence. In this world today, we shouldn't forget that in the midst of conflict and killing, there are people like these, people who are focused on what can be built rather than what can be destroyed, people who are focused on how they can help people that they've never met, people who define themselves not by what makes them different from other people, but by the humanity that we hold in common.
Yeah. Well said.
So there's obviously a great deal that's got to be done. Both he and President Putin are calling for a ceasefire so that an investigation can take place. The NTSB and FBI investigators are headed to Ukraine. The White House last night called for the scene to be kept, you know, intact. Anybody who's looked at that scene, you know, it's clearly not intact. That scene was being combed over by off-duty coal miners this morning, and people, right. You know, this scene is the most tarnished accident scene in the history.
You've got
of
everything from looters to curiosity seekers.
Absolutely. So they're just going to have to deal with that.
To do it yourself. Helpers.
Do-it-yourself helpers, exactly.
Yeah.
A federal appeals court today ruled for the second time that states cannot prevent gay people from getting married. Three-judge panel of the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver found a ban on same-sex marriage in Oklahoma violates the U.S. Constitution. And in a Utah case, the court ruled on the 25th of June that gay couples have a constitutional right to wed. So that's twice that court has ruled that way. Gay marriage on both states is on hold until appeals are resolved.
Yeah. When do you think this is going to go to the Supreme Court?
Wouldn't surprise me if it goes pretty soon, actually.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah. I think this is headed there. I wouldn't show down at the OK Corral.
Yeah.
This
next spring.
Next June, I would think we might be getting those decisions. Wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah.
President Obama said he's spoken today with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about the conflict in Gaza, underscored the U.S. support for Israel to defend itself, and he also said the U.S. and its allies are concerned about the risk of escalation in the conflict, and he's hopeful that Israel will continue to act in a way that minimizes civilian casualties.
Hmm.
Meanwhile, CNN correspondent Diana Magnay hasn't tweeted since Thursday when she referred to a group of Israelis who were cheering the bombing of Gaza as scum.
Hmm.
and she's been removed from her reporting of the conflict.
Yeah, it's pretty hot stuff.
Sure is.
Pretty hot stuff. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat.com and free-don.org. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is Professor Stephen Cohen, the contributing editor to The Nation, thenation.com, professor emeritus of Russian studies and politics at NYU and Princeton. His book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, which examines the new Cold War, is available in paperback. His writing's over at thenation.com. And Professor Cohen, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom.
I am curious your thoughts on this disaster, this the crash of this airplane over eastern Ukraine.
Well, help me. Where should we start?
How it's being played by the American press, how it's being played by the Russian press, what probably happened, how we got here. These are all questions that I don't know the answers to.
Well, I know the answer to the question how we got here, because you and I have talked about it for, I guess, 2 months now.
Yeah.
How it's being played in the two media is also not surprising to you or me. Alas, the American mainstream Putin press is saying essentially, somehow, directly or indirectly, the shoot down of that commercial aircraft is the fault of Russian President Vladimir Putin. It's rather torturous the way they come to that, but it's something like Putin created this crisis in the Ukraine. He gave weapons to the separatists. They weren't separatists, by the way, when it began. They were fighting for home rule. They're probably separatists now, having been bombed for a month by the Ukrainian government. And that somehow he's responsible and he's got to make amends and be punished. And that's what's going on now, hectoring, lecturing, imposing more sanctions on Putin, basically blaming Russia without any introspection as to our role. In Russia, it's, you know, the mirror image, and you're getting some serious and some wacko counter interpretation. The serious one is this is the fault of the United States, which empowered the Kiev government to wage a heavy artillery warplane attack on eastern cities in Ukraine. The rebels there got their hands on some air defense equipment. We don't know how sophisticated or what its range is. They had shot down Ukrainian warplanes with increasing frequency during the last 2 weeks under the mantra, we protect our own skies, you can't come and bomb our cities, can't come and kill our women and children. And so whether they shot this down by accident, we don't yet know. There are some wacko, I don't know if they're wacko, but there's some extreme theories in Moscow that have been put out by certain agencies that, in fact, Putin was returning yesterday from Brazil, and he flew somewhere roughly over or below in that same corridor. His presidential plane looks a little bit, if you've only got one eye, like that Malaysian aircraft, and in fact, whoever shot it down was actually aiming at Putin's plane. I rule that out. But you're asking what the media reaction is, and as since this crisis began, and I'll remind you, this is the worst American-Russian crisis since the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think it's the worst international crisis in the world today, far exceeding in its potential impact on our lives and the world, what's going on in Gaza and Israel and in Iraq. As from the very beginning, you have two colliding narratives, the American and the Russian. And my position has been for the last 3 months in my writings and with you on the air that there is something very substantial in the Russian narrative, that if we're going to have a political resolution, we have to take into account. And I would add only this, that these poor souls on this plane, nearly 300, are, if you think about it, the first non-residential victims of the new Cold War. In the previous Cold War, which lasted 45 years, planes were shot out of the air accidentally, on purpose. Innocents who had no relationship to either side died over the 45-year period.
A couple of Korean airline planes.
Exactly so. And now this new Cold War, which has been underway for at least, I'd say, since February, what is that, almost 3 months, now it's claimed its first victims who do not even live in the region. There have been a lot of innocent victims. The Ukrainian government has killed a lot of people in the eastern Ukrainian cities, which have an affinity for Russia because although they're Ukrainians ethnically, Russian is their native language, and some of them are ethnic Russians. I'd like to talk about what's been going on there because I think that's the backdrop to how this horror happened, that air war.
Yeah, why don't you do that? And also highlight or explain what you meant when you said that these folks, the quote, rebels, who probably shot this plane out of the air, it's increasingly looking like that, I think. That they were not fighting to join Russia, that they were fighting for home rule. What does that mean? And how?
Well, we had two or three international polls, surveys of people living in what's actually southeast Ukraine. That extends from Odessa, a city kind of known to many American Jews, for example, because a lot of our grandfathers immigrated from Odessa. This beautiful ocean, multi-ethnic city in southern Ukraine, and Crimea, which was annexed in March by Putin and is now part of Russia, eastward toward along the Russian border to what's called the Donbass, which is the heavy industrial defense complex part of Ukraine, was part of the Soviet Union, of course, but retains very strong economic links to Russia, and that's where these big industrial cities are, like Donetsk, which has 1 million people. That's where the two smaller cities, Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, which were battered into ruins, finally fell to the Ukrainian army, to the Kiev army, a couple weeks ago. Those people were polled, Tom, in, I think, November, December, January. Now, that's when the protest against the former Ukrainian government of elected President Yanukovych began in the streets of Kiev at the so-called Maidan. And when those polls were taken, it showed that more than 80% did not want to join Russia. They didn't want to become part of the Russian Federation. What they wanted was what the British call home rule or more home rule or what we call states' rights or what's called internationally a federal system. Because the Ukrainian political system had been extremely unitary, power concentrated in Kiev. For example, and this is the most important example, of the regions of Ukraine, I forget how many there are, I think there are 18, there may be 20-some-odd, which are roughly equivalent territorially to our states, each has a governor. They were appointed by Kiev, either by the parliament or the president, but they were not elected in the regions. Therefore, the people who lived in these regions had no direct political representation on their own territory. They wanted that changed, and the reason they wanted it changed is that, as in the United States, a lot of states determine their own cultural, even their own economic relations. New York State, for example, has economic relations with other countries that have nothing to do with the federal government.
Right.
So, and also, by having local elections, you create a local political elite, a political class, that has a stake in appeasing or winning over the constituency so it can win elections. We know that from the United States. But if you're appointing even mayors and you're appointing governors, they are obliged only to the capital. They have to appease Kiev, not their local voters.
So the mayors in these towns in southeast Ukraine were also appointed by Kiev?
It varied from territory to territory. So, but the point is that there was very little local representation in these, in terms of power.
Right.
So one of the grievances, because the country is so split historically, ethnically, politically, culturally, religiously, is that people wanted to elect their own officials. That was an issue that led to the crisis, and that's what they were fighting for originally. Now,
Professor Cohen, we have to take just a quick pause. We'll be right back with Professor Stephen Cohen.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can read Professor Cohen's writings over at thenation.com, and his book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, now out in paperback. We'll be right back. So, Professor Cohen, you were saying originally
they were not clamoring to leave Russia. In other words,
Ukraine.
To leave Ukraine, yeah. Crimea was an exception. Almost 80% of the citizens of Crimea were ethnic Russians or spoke Russian as their only language.
Right.
Crimea had long been part of Russia. There had long been, since the end of the Soviet Union, a desire in Crimea to be territorially a part of Russia. When the crisis began and Putin became convinced, rightly or wrongly, that the fall of the Ukrainian government by a street mob and then backed by the White House and Europe was actually the beginning of a move on Crimea, where the Russian naval base is at Sevastopol, he moved toward the annexation of Crimea to protect it. That's what he thought he was doing. We interpreted differently. But that was clearly the anxiety in Moscow. However, the rest of southeastern Ukraine, to repeat my point, back then, in early 2014, overwhelmingly, 80% wanted to remain in Ukraine. They just wanted a federal Ukrainian government. Now, I don't know, there haven't been any polls, but when you bomb these people relentlessly, creating maybe as many as 400,000 refugees who have fled to Russia, who are living in tent cities in Rostov province across the border, when you've killed, we don't have a civilian number, a non-combatant number, but it's surely in the thousands by now, and this includes women and children. And when you've leveled the infrastructure of these cities, I'm sure you're going to get a different result. The result, if you take a poll, people are going to say, we got to be in Russia. We got to be protected from these people. So I don't know what it is now, but it didn't begin that way. Look, Tom, the problem with our American understanding of this terrible crisis is our mainstream media has deleted so much of the story. Two things they deleted. They've called all the fighters and resistance in southeastern Ukraine separatists. That is, they want to leave Ukraine. That was not so at the beginning. The other thing, and more important thing they've omitted, is they have deleted the bombardment of these cities by the American-backed government in Kiev, which has now been going on, well, it's been going on since June, but it intensified on July 1. And that devastation led the rebels, as I call them, or the separatists, as the New York Times calls them, to try to defend the airspace over those cities. And beginning a few weeks ago, they began shooting down incoming Ukrainian aircraft. This was everything from convoy planes carrying military equipment and troops to fighter jets. In fact, it appears that the day the Malaysian aircraft was shot down yesterday, 2 or 3 hours earlier in the morning, the Ukrainian rebels shot down an incoming Ukrainian fighter jet, and we know that because the pilot bailed out and lived to tell the tale.
Is this the one that the intercepted phone conversation was referring to?
That's a fantastic question. I have listened to that so-called intercept where the guy, the rebel, says either, and it depends on how you translate the Russian, because the verb could be translated two ways, either, we shot one down, or they shot one down. But was he referring to the Malaysian aircraft, or was he referring to the fighter jet?
Right. Okay, let's get back to that in just a second. We have to take just a very quick break. We're with Professor Stephen Cohen, contributing editor to The Nation, thenation.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Tom Harbin here with you. Professor Stephen Cohen with us. His most recent article in The Nation, thenation.com, is titled Kiev's Atrocities and the Silence of the Hawks. We were just talking about how many of these, quote, rebels in southeast Ukraine wanted a federal system in their country. They wanted to be able to elect their own governors and mayors rather than having them appointed from Kiev, from the capital city, that they've been being bombed by Kiev over the last few weeks, that they've started now shooting down the planes that have been bombing their cities. And we were talking about this telephone conversation that was intercepted, that was put out yesterday by the Ukrainian government as evidence that these were the folks who shot down the Malaysian Airlines plane. Your thoughts on that?
Three capitals are providing information to you and me in the media, though I try to get some information elsewhere. One is Washington, one is Kiev, one is Moscow. They all lie. Now, they don't lie 100%. They lie some percent. And so it's left on people such as you and me to figure out what part of what they're saying is a lie. Kiev, however, is the biggest liar of them all. It lies more quantitatively than Moscow. The problem is Washington tends to repeat whatever Kiev says. So do the reporters for major American medias. They encamp in Kiev, or they take the statements of the Kiev government and they just repeat them. So how to evaluate this information, I don't know. But look, Tom, we may never know who shot down this airplane, or we may know. It all depends on whether the investigation is going to be politicized or not. Now, when the head of Malaysian, or the prime minister of Malaysia, tells us not to worry, Malaysia will get to the bottom of this, it's like a sick joke. They still can't find their lost aircraft.
Yeah.
So we are hardly going to rely on Malaysia.
In fact, people are making jokes right now that this finally we found the plane that was lost over the Pacific.
Well, actually, yesterday when I got up in the morning and heard about a plane on the ground, the first report I heard is that they'd found the missing Malaysian airliner. People thought at first that's the ruins of that was the airliner.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that shows you that all of us are victim of a media atmosphere that's polarized and is distorted and is falsified either inadvertently or on purpose. But look, let's look at the consequences of this shootdown. First of all, you know, 300 souls have been lost. Secondly, that was a very international flight. The majority of the people on there were Dutch because the plane originated in Amsterdam. So we've got a big political fallout. First of all, it deepens and prolongs the new Cold War. That's beyond any dispute. People who thought we might get out of this Cold War quickly and it wouldn't grow into a decades-long one, have I argued otherwise? You remember, I've been arguing with you, I was saying on your show, that because the epicenter of this new Cold War is on Russia's borders, it can be more dangerous than the last one.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're getting a sense of what I was thinking about. Secondly, when this happened, on the eve of it, France and Germany were resisting the White House hawkish position. They wanted a ceasefire so that negotiations began, and they thought Putin was at least 50% right. Now their political support may be lost because so many Europeans were on this plane and because it was so horrific. If European opinion blames Putin, not all of it will, but enough of it, Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, won't be able to play the role between Putin and Obama that she's been playing. That is, trying to get Obama to talk on a more negotiating basis with Putin.
Right.
Meanwhile, Putin's position in Russia, and if you look at my new article, The Silence of the Hawks, at The Nation, I give the evidence that Putin has been under tremendous pressure in Russia to intervene in Ukraine to protect these cities, to declare a no-fly zone. Now his position is even weaker in the sense of pressure on him. But there is one ray of light, and I hate to even mention it. with 300 people dead, but it's this. The rebels, the fighters, the separatists, who probably shot down the plane, but we don't know, by mistake, they thought it was an incoming Ukrainian military plane. And by the way, that plane was off course. Why was it over Donetsk? In fact, why would any commercial airline be flying over Ukraine in the last 2 or 3 weeks when there have been air wars? I mean, what in the, who runs the International Aviation Authority?
Right.
Those planes never should have been anywhere near Ukraine. You or I would not get on a plane if we, the pilot said, hey, guys, you're going to have a great view out the window. You want to see a war? We're going to fly over Donetsk. We'd get off that plane before it departed. But the point is, the rebels have said that they will declare a humanitarian ceasefire so that the investigators, the inspectors, can get to the crash site. If Kiev says, okay, we will too, we have a window of opportunity during this ceasefire for political negotiations to end this war. Now, there was a ceasefire that lasted 3 or 4 days, and the president of Ukraine called it off with the backing of the United States and against the opposition, hear me on this, against the opposition of Germany and France. The only way a political negotiation can come about is if there's a ceasefire. Now there may be one born of tragedy if the rebels act on what they've promised, a humanitarian ceasefire, and Kiev agrees. Then the fighting will stop. The inspectors will go in. Obama, Putin, Merkel, Brussels, the UN can do what we pay them to do in this war. So there is a slight ray of hope, and we'll probably know today or tomorrow or the next day whether it's going to be realized. That's the only decent news that comes out of this horror.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like a bucket of cold water in the face, I'm guessing, for the rebels, particularly if there's a local group that, you know, thought they were gleefully shooting a Ukrainian plane out of the sky, and then they see bodies raining down on top of
them. Yeah, but Tom, here's the problem. There's not one group. The rebels are, you know, there's a lot of them now. There's thousands and thousands of them, and they've got weapons, and they're getting more weapons. Where they're getting from, we could have another discussion about that.
Yeah.
But the problem is they aren't a united group. There are different militias fighting in different areas under different field commanders and with different political support.
Wow. Professor Stephen Cohen, it is always a pleasure speaking with you, sir. Thank you so much for dropping by.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You can read Professor Cohen's most recent piece, The Silence of the Hawks, about Kiev's atrocities, over at thenation.com. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Anything Goes Friday continues. Michelle in Chipley, Florida. Hey, Michelle, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I was wondering why you refer to climate change and global warming. You don't ever mention geoengineering. What's your thoughts on that? Are they not spraying over Washington?
They're not, no. The state of the art of geoengineering is pretty crude. I mean, the Chinese used, I believe it was iodine, during the Olympics to empty rain out of the clouds before they got to Beijing. And that's pretty much about it. The idea that we can damage the atmosphere by pumping it full of carbon dioxide and methane and then fix that damage by doing things like, for example, spraying titanium dioxide in the upper atmosphere by adding it to jet fuel or something, which is not being done. The idea that we can do that and that's going to solve our problems is dumb. One of the biggest problems we have right now is the extra carbon dioxide is being absorbed by our oceans, and it's acidifying them, and it's killing the bottom half of the food chain. And there is no credible geoengineering solutions that I know of. Do you know of any?
No, not solutions. It's what they are spraying, that they're doing all the X's and the spraying in the sky.
No, that's water vapor from jet engines. When you burn any kind of hydrocarbon, the jet fuel You know, the core of hydrocarbons is these molecules that have hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon in them. And when you burn that, when you ignite it, the carbon oxidizes, it splits off, and it bonds to oxygen, and it comes out as CO2. And then the extra hydrogen bonds to oxygen, and it comes out as H2O. Two hydrogens and one oxygen. H2O is what we refer to as water. So when you burn jet fuel, one of the waste products of it is water vapor. If you spray water vapor at 30,000 feet, 9 miles up, where it is 80 degrees below zero, it immediately freezes. And that water vapor that immediately freezes and turns to little tiny ice crystals, that's what you see coming out of the back end of a jet when it's flying at that altitude. It's got nothing to do with anything else.
And you're positive in that.
I am absolutely positive of that, Michelle. If they tried to run anything other than jet fuel through those engines, these engines are made of aluminum. Well, there's a fair amount of titanium in it, but you know they're very delicate precision machines. And if you try to run something through those machines that gums them up, A and B, anybody who works in the aviation industry, I mean, if there was some giant conspiracy to put things in jet fuel to either turn us dumb or to reflect the sun back or whatever, I mean, whatever it might be, somebody would come forward and say, here's an ounce of jet fuel, analyze it. I mean, you can buy jet fuel anywhere.
It's not the fuel.
So you think the planes, commercial planes, are modified to do like crop dusting?
I do. What about Dane Whittington?
What about what?
Dane Whittington.
I have no idea what that is.
Okay, well, that's a person, and...
Well, just because somebody says it doesn't make it true. Again,
no,
you've got...
What about aluminum?
Well, planes are made out of aluminum. But that's not what's... You know, what you're seeing when you look up in the sky, what you are seeing is water vapor. And 9/11, we had 3 or 4 days where there was no planes flying. And all that water vapor that was up there in the upper atmosphere vanished, and the skies were clear. And one of the things that we actually discovered is that the ice crystals from those jet planes are actually very slightly, a 100,000th of a degree, but very slightly cooling our planet. And so you could argue that that's a good thing in a warming Earth, but there's nowhere near enough of it to really have any kind of consequential effect or to affect the global warming that's going on as a consequence of those very hydrocarbons being emitted. Because, in addition to water coming out of those jet engines, you've got carbon dioxide coming out of those jet engines at those upper altitudes where it becomes more of a greenhouse gas. So, you know, it's just that's the problem. Michelle, I'm familiar with the whole contrails thing, and I'm telling you, it's nonsense. Thank you for the call. Howard in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Howard. You wanted to talk about getting the vote out?
Yeah. Also, I wanted to mention I'm just getting out of a bromide buzz. I've got one other quickie, Nike, I believe.
You know something about bromides? I know nothing about this. I'm assuming it's another kind of fluoride thing. You know, it's a conspiracy to get us.
Sounded credible. What you were saying sounded credible.
Okay.
I understand that Nike's putting a lot of money out now trying to find Bigfoot. They understand that he's wearing
Nikes?
Triple double X. They want him as a spokesman. So, anyway, I have got the answer to winning the next election, and I just can't get anybody to listen to it.
Okay.
In front of me, I've got a list of the people on my block. I can assure you that 90% of the Democrats will vote, because if they don't, they're going to have to answer to me.
So the 90% of the Democrats on your block will vote because you're going to go around your block and knock on their doors.
Yeah, they're going to either go to the polls and I'll be there to greet them, and or they'll get absentee ballots.
Right.
And I'm going to the precinct leader and finding out whether he's got the same thing going on every other block, and if not, why not?
Right.
And then we will start recruiting other block captains. And if this can be done, and it can be done relatively quickly, and I'm used to this kind of thing because I was involved with Amway at one time.
Yep.
So you get to understand the numbers, how the numbers can grow when
yep.
you're recruiting people. This can be done nationally in a matter of a couple of months for the next election. We could probably assure that we have 80% of the Democrats out to vote. That guarantees a win.
That would be great, Howard. That would be great.
I can't get to anybody. I go to the DCC, the DLC, the DSC, the DCCCC, and I can't get anybody to listen. It's driving me nuts.
Well, I thought they were already doing something about this. I mean, there's a huge get out the vote effort going on that the Democratic Party is
well,
running.
And phone banks, Tom, they're a waste. They call people up and say, get out the vote.
Right.
Yeah. That doesn't do anything.
It needs to be on the ground. They need to get a block. You're talking about kind of like old machine politics where, you know, every block has a block captain and he's responsible for getting out the vote. Only instead of, in this case, getting out the vote for the corrupt politician, you know, the old Tammany Hall machine, basically, that got Franklin Roosevelt elected governor of New York, rather than that kind of a program, a corrupt machine, you're talking about a machine that's grassroots driven.
I call it semi-corrupt.
Semi-corrupt. There you go.
I'll take that over. It's totally corrupt.
There you go. Howard, excellent suggestion. Maybe there's somebody listening who will respond to you. Thank you for calling, and thanks for sharing it. I appreciate it. John in Seaside, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I had a question for you. I've called in the show before, and I was expressed my concern over possible runaway debt service on our debt if we reached a certain point.
Right.
And your response to that was that the Japanese have run up their debt 200% of GDP and really aren't experiencing any major problems. I've always read that the purpose that debt serves in a monetary system is to make sure that legislators are spending the money that they borrow on things that will create economic growth. They're spending it wisely. If we can go so far into debt, if we could go 200% of GDP if we had to, what purpose does debt serve in our monetary system?
That's an excellent question. First of all, the purpose that you defined is not one that I've ever heard. I mean, there's a certain common sense associated with it, but the reality is that the last $5 trillion, roughly, of debt that came along with the Bush administration, about $2 trillion of it was created by his tax cuts. About $2 trillion of it was created by his wars, and another trillion of it was created by the recession, causing a diminution, a loss, a dropping off of tax revenues. But, you know, by the great crash of 2007-2008, which continues to haunt us. And so I would agree with you that, and this is what Franklin Roosevelt did, and this is what Dwight Eisenhower did, it's what Harry Truman did, is what was done after World War II, that borrowing, and we were at 127% of GDP in terms of our debt after World War II, by the way. We were much higher than we are right now. And what those three presidents did was borrow money. Well, FDR was borrowing money to fight World War II, but after that, Dwight Eisenhower was borrowing money to invest in the interstate highway system, to invest in schools, to invest in local roads, to invest in hospitals. Jack Kennedy gave a famous speech. I've got a clip of it around here someplace, where he pointed out that, you know, a third of the cost of all the hospitals that had been built since 1950 was paid for by the federal government, and it was paid for mostly by debt. And the consequence of all these things, because these are expenses, not investments. During a war, it's an expense. You're building bombs that get dropped on some other country, and that money is gone. But if you build a hospital or you build a school, or you build a road, you spend $1 trillion over the next 20, 30 years, or you educate people with a GI Bill over the next 20, 30 years, you spend $1 trillion, you get back $2 trillion or $3 trillion or $5 trillion. And we have always understood debt that way. And we have, I mean, we were in massive debt after the Civil War, too, the same thing. And you had presidents who were spending debt-based spending to get us out of the Depression after the Civil War. So that, you know, this is the John, thank you for the call. This is the biggest distinction that Americans fail to make, is the distinction between spending government money and investing government money. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Spending costs money, right? But investing returns. Welcome back. Marlene in Gary, Indiana. Hey, Marlene, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am well. Thank you for watching Free Speech TV.
Yeah, okay. What I want to say is this I'm not sure that everybody understands that every time ICE call one of these meetings to investigate, that it costs the public money.
Right. He has spent so far...
our tax money to do this.
Yeah, he spent more money investigating Benghazi than
right.
You know, we've spent.
The same day that President Obama asked for that money in order to help these kids, right, through no fault of their own. If they were killing my kids in the neighborhood, I'd try to move to another country, too. You yep. know, but the same day that he asked for this money to help these kids, ICE and them asked for $4 million to do another investigation on Benghazi.
Right. He's a...
I'm not hearing that on the news media.
Yeah.
I have stopped looking at 2579 because they're not talking about... In the middle of the news, they want to tell me how to cook a juicy hamburger. So I don't look at those news. I look at programs like yours and CBSN...
Yeah.
Because I want to know the facts. But I don't think most Americans are aware that 54 votes on Obamacare, they're using our tax dollars for that.
Yeah, yeah, and they're using our tax dollars. And
things on Benghazi, our tax dollars are using that. But yet they can't give us money to fix the highways and the byways. They can't give us money to fix the bridges that's falling down.
Yep. I am totally with you, Marlene. I've pointed these things out on this program. I think other progressive commentators have done the same. And it doesn't punch through the mainstream media, which is always afraid to challenge power. It's, I mean,
right.
This is just, you know, they're always afraid to challenge power. And Daryl Issa
is very powerful. And as far as
your man,
you know, Senator McCain, he's getting flashbacks of the Vietnam War. I think what they ought to do is take McCain and anybody else who want to sign up, give them weapons, drop them out of a plane over some of these territories that they want to fight in.
Right.
Because we've lost over 4,000 men and women. That's enough.
Yeah. So if McCain wants a war, let him have one. Put him in uniform and drop him in the middle of Benghazi.
Put him on a plane and drop him out. You know, have him show us how it should be done.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, he tried to do that once, and it didn't work out so well.
Yeah.
That's
he
amazing.
He acts like he's starving for a war.
Of course he is. He's always been spoiling for a war. I think that his experience in Vietnam deformed him. And
And
I think the man is suffering from a war trauma and is imposing that that trauma on the rest of us, you know, that kind of war psychosis on all of us. So, Marlene, I'm with you. I'm completely with you, and I think you said it brilliantly. Thank you so much for calling and for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to every one of the people at the various companies that syndicate this show, Westwood One and Commercial Radio, Pacifica on non-commercial radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, and all the cable providers who carry our show directly, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, and others. To the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio at netrootsradio.com, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, hey, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Nay, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli, who does our tech support, to our affiliates, our radio and television stations and cable stations that carry this program, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program, for letting them know that you're watching or listening and that you like it or don't, as the case may be. Thank you. Thank you. You keep us on the air. Flo in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Flo, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, we like your show. Following you ever since you were on the air.
Oh, you've been calling for years.
I know.
Yeah. Thank you, Flo.
You're not going to get rid of me, are you?
I appreciate you. What's on your mind?
I was watching C-SPAN on the embassy thing, and they're going to build a billion-dollar embassy in England, mm-hmm. London. And some of the Republicans said, well, why so much? Because property is expensive in London. But in the meantime, we have our government telling us not to buy things we can't afford. And according to half of our government, you know, we're in debt. C-SPAN did the debt thing this morning.
Right.
On the entitlements. It's always the entitlement problem.
Right, right. We're in debt, so we can't afford to have Social Security or unemployment insurance.
But a billion-dollar embassy. Remember when they built that $750 million embassy in Iraq?
Right. It ended up costing more than $1 billion.
Yeah, but this one here is probably going to be more secure than the Iraqi one.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. In fact, the Iraqi one, they're fixing to evacuate right now, I think. It's not a good situation. I shouldn't laugh about it. Because, you know, Dick Cheney and George W. Bush, they broke that country bad.
Let me laugh today just once.
Okay. Well,
I enjoyed it.
Okay. Good. Flo, thanks a lot for the call. It's always nice to hear from you. Jody in Lexington, Kentucky. Hey, Jody, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Thanks for taking the call. I listen to XM Progress
great.
Pretty much all day long.
Thank you.
I have not yet heard, and maybe you have, any kind of effort to pound home to the American people exactly what we're dealing with when we're talking about the conservatives and the Tea Party. I mean, like, what I would like to see, this is what I want. I want to see us put forward a bill, one a day, every single day, until the elections come around. And as they're voting on these issues that are important to us, like minimum wage, like education finance reform, like soft money reforms, like Hobby Lobby, you name it, whatever, I want to see one bill every single day that's important to the American people, the average Joe.
I guarantee you, Jody, every day in the House of Representatives, there are Democrats presenting bills like that to John Boehner, and John Boehner refuses to bring them to the floor. And every day in the Senate, there are bills like that that are being proposed by members that, where they just can't get enough, you know, they can't get the Republicans to go along with it. It's like, but you're saying that you want it done in a way that everybody knows it. And this is the problem, is that the media, our corporate media, our mainstream media is so invested because their business model requires them to have, you know, John McCain and Lindsey Graham on television all the time, or basically, you know, Republicans. They are unwilling to call them out for what they're doing, because what they're doing is just naked obstruction. We are 6 years into a plan that was hatched at the caucus room restaurant the night that President Obama was inaugurated. We're 6 years into this plan to destroy the presidency of America's first black president. And to destroy it in such a way that there'll be no legacy, there'll be nothing. And now the one thing that he was able to get through, I mean, he got through a whole lot of things in the 74, I think it was, legislative days that, you know, he actually controlled both bodies, or the Democrats actually controlled both bodies. But the one really significant legislative legacy that he has is Obamacare, and the Republicans are trying to blow that up. And in all the various states, you've got 5 million people who don't have access to health care because the state governments, state governors like Rick Scott, Pat McCrory, are refusing to expand Medicaid. And so the media will not carry the story. Those pieces of legislation are being dropped, Jody. They are being proposed constantly. And it just doesn't get out. The House Progressive Caucus has, press meetings, and every single week I get a press release from them about a meeting that they're having, and they're inviting the press to show up. The press hasn't covered the House Progressive Caucus in years. So, Jody, that's the problem. Thanks for the call. It's interesting. Patricia in Sacramento, we have just about 30 seconds left. You want to make a quick point about Professor Cohen?
Tom, I'll try to make a quick point. I'm just wondering if you foresee something else here with this Malaysian airliner that was downed, and that the U.S. government immediately seems like they're hinting towards blaming the Russians. When we look at, you know, if we look at the history of this, Victoria Nuland's conversation leaked, the Ukrainian president overthrown with a pro-U.S. President in place now. I'm just wondering, based on all this information, I just don't know how to look at it, Tom. Like, are we trying to provoke something with Russia?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think that there has been, you know, some bad statecraft on both sides over the years, but I don't see any kind of American conspiracy here. Frankly, I don't see a Russian conspiracy. I see a mess in Ukraine that is spilling out all over the place in a bad way. Patricia, thank you for the call, and thanks for being with us today and this week. We'll see you next Monday, and don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It doesn't just instantly appear. You've got to participate. Tag, you're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.